There was a suggestion that we might try to set the tone for the evening and Bill Riley's remarks to us today. And one of our resident scholars, Chuck Elkins, and also the executive director, suggested a little quote from Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Not Lord of the Flies, that was different. This is Lord of the Rings. So it goes, "I wish it need not have happened in my time." "So do I," said Gandalf, "and so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." So we are having the distinguished opportunity to hear from a man who has used his time extremely well. And I am hoping that when we leave tonight, be it in Zoom land or from here, that we will also be inspired to use our time as best we can. And I'm confident that that will happen. It's very difficult to introduce someone who does not need to be introduced, because if I fully introduced him, it would be the end of the program. So I am not going to introduce all of the elements that Bill Riley has contributed to this world of ours. But I will say that we are so fortunate to have an incredibly distinguished leadership that he has provided in the public, private, nonprofit, and academic sectors. Most importantly for us, he was our administrator from 1989 to 1993. So, in the spirit of "we are not done yet," and we aren't, please join me in welcoming the environmental leader for all seasons, in all places, at all times, Bill Riley.
Thank you, Dave. It's really a pleasure to look out here and see a number of familiar faces, not many, though, that date from my own time, I think. I regard you all as family, and I have to say that the EPA Alumni Association clearly does too. The kind of compassion that has been shown in materials I have seen for the people who are losing their jobs or expecting to, their housing problems, their financial issues, has really been remarkable. It's a great tribute to your continuing loyalty and compassion, and is a mark, I think, of pride for EPA. I wish that a lot of that would not be necessary. You all do too. I've been discouraged from talking about how bad things are tonight. It was pointed out to me, however bad they are, they're much worse for us than they are for you. That can be said. I think back before I was at EPA, I encountered Guy Darst. Some of you may remember him. He was the AP reporter at the time, and he said, "You're going to the best agency." And I said, "That's not the perception among environmentalists. If it, is it the perception on the street?" And he said, "Anybody who has covered as many as I have is quite aware that EPA will make 10 decisions in a week that would totally tear up virtually any other agency in town if it were just doing one." That's what EPA does: conflicts of economics and health and environment, and it's their bread and butter. Well, I was very pleased to hear that, and not too long after that, I had occasion to ask the Interior Secretary Manuel Lujan. We were traveling somewhere together, and I said, "Are you enjoying your job, Manuel?" He said, "Do you have any idea what I was doing before? I was ranking in the House, in a Democratic House. They gave me nothing to do. This is a terrific job." And he said, "I mean, I do have some problems. The Fish and Wildlife Service and the parks." He said, "You know, when I give an order, the Bureau of Mines and Reclamation, they salute and say, 'Yes, sir,' and they get the job done. But the Park Service, Fish and Wildlife, They've got to check with God first. And then he looked at me, he said, oh, I forgot who I was talking to. That's all you got is people who are in touch with God. And more power to you. I had an experience when some of you may know, I spent a time in private equity. I founded a fund that addressed water and sanitation issues in developing countries and had some OSHA support, not OSHA support from the government agency that provided that kind of money. And I had a very good bit of private money for it. So I was at Ford Foundation, and it was my first fundraising for that. And I talked about, with some feeling apparently, about child mortality, about the sickness and illness, impairments to economic productivity and performance, and all of the consequences of having too little water or contaminated water. And I was accompanied by the top fundraising advisor to TPG, a major private equity group that I was part of. And we finished, and I asked him, how'd I do? And very tactfully, he said, oh, you did fine, but in future, you might lighten up on the dead babies. So tonight, I'm going to lighten up on the dead babies. I hope you'll understand. It isn't because there aren't a lot of dead babies, and it isn't because many of them are to our account, as Bill Gates has pointed out recently, quite fairly. It's that we have a lot of other things to cover, and many of them are important and are to the credit of people in this audience, of the history of the agency that we served. I have asked myself over and over again, why the deep anger in the country that led so many to express themselves so negatively? Polls have shown that anger has continued. It's pervasive in many places. It's pervasive in my native town in central Illinois. I go back there regularly because I have a farm 16 miles east of Decatur, Illinois. And I recall a meeting that I had every meeting that I have, the farmer has typically asked me whether I'm staying in Decatur that evening, and I usually stay at a Hilton Hotel in Chicago at the airport and go back to California. And I say, why do you always ask me that? And he said, because if you were going to stay, I would say, don't go out after dark. I said, really, this wholesome little town of 100,000 people? He said, no, it's really overrun by gangs. And his wife then spoke up, and she was head of obstetrics at the major public hospital in Decatur. And she said in the 11 years of her service there, almost 50%, well over 40% of the women she delivered were on meth or cocaine. And I realized that this was a place that had become highly impacted by the economic loss of five or six major companies, BorgWarner and Bridgestone Tire, and I think Firestone was one of them. Any rate, the economy was a wreck, and so were the people. And they are clearly angry and have a right to be. And as I have told this story to others, I've been told that if you were from a Midwestern city and it didn't have a college, probably it had a major fentanyl or drug problem or opiate problem. And I think that has contributed to a perception that somehow, I raised this question with a White House representative you would all know, who spoke to the board of World Wildlife Fund. And I said, did we just miss it? Those of us, I testified seven times for the North American Free Trade Agreement. And he paused for a long while and he said, I think we did miss it. But that's associated apparently with a whole range of other economic and social problems. And I think one of the realities is that woke, so to speak, was driven to extremes in a way that I think really upset a great many people. I know in California, the California system required essentially kind of loyalty oaths to DEI for promotions in academic situations, and even mathematics teachers had to plead their sensitivity to the issue and what they were doing about it. Same was true at the University of Michigan and many other places as well. And I think there is a certain sense of that needing correction. And it needs, I think we need to be not forgiving, but certainly understanding about the anger that seems to characterize the treatment of DEI, which otherwise seems to be an ordinary, humanely sensitive proposition. Well, the challenges facing EPA are not without precedent. I think they are of a much greater significance and danger than they may ever have been in the life of that 55-year-old agency. But we have come through a lot. Many of you are veterans, some victims, no doubt, of some of the downs, one of which came fairly early in the administration when the Arab oil embargo took place. My beloved mentor and friend Russell Train was the administrator at that time. When he was asked in his exit interview for his memoir, what was his proudest achievement? He said it was holding the place together and the integrity of what we did in the middle of enormous pressures to relax it all during that period. The period was highly inflationary. It was highly alarming. It was terrible for the president. We came through it, and it was kind of the first severe test of the agency and its capacity. Again, in the early 1980s, we had a catastrophic situation at the agency that led to the loss of the administrator and then to people going to prison. And you may remember that was a rough 2 years of heavy focus on deregulation and disregard for a lot of values that we brought to the job and wanted to see continued. I look back at 4 years ago during the Trump administration and the period just before 4 years, that when I would speak in various places and young EPA staffers would come up to me and say, what do you think we ought to do? We didn't join public service and EPA to do what we're now doing. And I told the story of Don Clay, who many of you will remember. And Don Clay, when I took office, very early on said two things. He said, run like hell. He said, you have been confirmed. There are no assistant secretaries that have been. Now is the chance to do what you want to do. And we developed the Clean Air Act. But we used a lot of the research and the materials that had been prepared by Don Clay and his staff during the 8 years previous to that, when there was not a chance that it was going to result in a proposal for a new Clean Air Act. He oversaw that. His staff and team put it together. Economic analysis, health data, environmental information. So they handed me a completed piece of work that would put us in great shape to start and run like hell, as we did. And we had the Clean Air Act ready to submit in June. And I've often thought of the patience and commitment that that staff, led by Don, showed for that period. They never lost faith that their moment would come, and it did. And we made the most of it. Well, EPA is the gold standard of environmental agencies worldwide. That has been attested to so many times in the course of my life. I have often said EPA is more revered with every mile that you set between yourself, between Washington and where you're going. But be that as it may, I look back at one experience that we had when there was a major spill of some kind in the Soviet Union, and it was flowing into and impairing the waters of Estonia. The Russians offered to clean it up and to characterize it, and Estonia was not about to agree to that. So we sent two people from the water staff, and I got a letter I wish to heaven I had preserved, but it said, the two people that you sent have been so helpful and constructive and so able that We are agreed that this is the most exciting visit that we have had from an American since Lindbergh. Now, that's right up there, you know? There ought to be a Lindbergh Award for those two. I wish to heaven I could say exactly who they were, and I can't. But that I put those kinds of experiences, and we had many of them, where we dealt with the Mexicans who had a whole range of issues that we tried to address. There was a Moroccan fire that we were very important to addressing. And we used the resources that we had, which were considerable, and sent very able and very responsible people to help deal with it. And invariably, it had the effect of animating the energy and the sense of purpose and satisfaction and fulfillment of the people who did it. Now, invariably, we had to steal from some budget in the agency to attend to some of those international problems, but nobody minded. Well, I recall one of those attestations to our value occurred when the Chinese invited me to come and help design a new environmental protection agency for them. And so I went to China, and I'd been doing that with the Energy Foundation for a number of years. We advised on a whole range of subjects and actually financed, and that was possible. We could finance some government bureaus even who otherwise could not raise the funds. And I met with a group of relatively young people who were actually writing the legislation. And the question that I got in a room about like this, with about the same many number of people present, what did you do at EPA to get the people and the states to do what you needed them to do to comply with your law? And I said, well, and we were talking mostly about the Air Act and sulfur dioxide problem, dioxide problem in China. I said, well, we could take away highway funds. No, we don't have that opportunity. They pay no attention to us, though, in Beijing. But we could never do that. Well, we had the courts. And the courts sustained so much of what the Congress passed, sometimes to a degree that no one expected. Even the senators who were responsible for the National Environmental Policy Act, oddly, given their sophistication, were astonished to find that it was used in litigation against the Alaska pipeline. And it reminded me of the story of Winston Churchill and the leader of the opposition party, who was the prime minister at the time, peering in the men's room together next to urinals, whereupon Churchill chose to go to another urinal. And the labor leader said, well, you know, I didn't think things had gotten that bad. And he said, well, it's only that everything you see running smoothly, you nationalize. Any rate, we didn't have the courts. I said the press was exceedingly important to us. The press took the issue seriously, and the culture paid attention and responded. No, we don't have that. Well, NGOs, I knew better than that. I was there. World Wildlife Fund did have an office in China, but it had to be extremely careful. And at this point, I was running out of answers, but I was reminded how it took the whole culture. It took all Americans and all of these institutions to achieve what we did in America. A young woman rose in the crowd. She was not an employee of the government. She worked for World Wildlife Fund China. And she said, sir, you might explain your voluntary programs. Well, it hadn't occurred to me. And I explained 3350, which is the third and a half of permissible, but relatively small doses, small amounts of pollutants, toxics, and how we founded that and made that available to companies, many of which joined it. And then I got the question, what did you do for those companies that complied with 3350? What did they get? And I said, well, they got a flag to fly over their plant and a nice letter from me. I was a little embarrassed. And I remember the reaction was a great, exciting burst of conversation among the Chinese. And one of them finally said in English, that could work. Well, they founded an organization. They started with 1,000. They went to 10,000. They went to 100,000. I don't understand the culture well enough to know how it is, but apparently, if you are one of those companies, you dare not fail to be included. Well, that reminded me of some of the other voluntary programs we had. And some of you may have seen that I credited John Hoffman in a piece that was in the Washington Post yesterday, day before, for bringing to me a proposal to affect the lighting of companies all across the country. And I have to confess, I laughed. And I said, you really mean to say with a straight face that EPA has figured out how to save a huge amount of money for American business that they didn't know they had? Yes, he said, very straight-faced. And I said, why? He said, because they take their lighting bill as incidental. They simply pay the utility. They don't pay attention to it as a cost center. He was absolutely right. And within a year, lighting was being changed all across the country with longer lasting lights, lights just with the same lumens, and also lights that required replacement much less often. And that turned out to be one of the big savings associated with green lights. Well, when he brought the next proposal to me, I was all ears. And the next proposal was Energy Star. And once again, he was aware of cost savings that business was not. And we took him seriously. His team was really centrally involved in all of this. And we proceeded to announce it first for buildings. And then we added, after a year, appliances and homes. And it just took off. It is universally popular. It made environmentalists of real estate developers. I had a major developer in California tell me that the best regulation you ever had is not even a regulation, it's Energy Star. He said, you cannot build a significant building in the state of California if it's not going to carry the star. Well, the appliance people feel just the same way. Carrier, Bosch, others are on record as objecting to the termination of that program. It costs $32 million. The president's birthday parade is going to cost $45. It seems like we might maybe be able to come up with it. And I hoped in the op-ed that I wrote, which is I remember very well, it makes plain to the EPA administrator and to the administration that it's not about climate. Apparently, it's being terminated as part of the climate program. Well, it never was about climate. It was always about saving money and energy efficiency and the reduction of pollution associated with that saving, including hundreds of thousands of cars. And I forget the number of tons of metrics that is involved of savings, but it's a hugely successful program and it's affected the whole country. And if you are in the real estate business and you have a building that you want to sell, you market it. If it holds the green star, the star, you market with that advantage. At any rate, I had a friend once who left the seminary and he went to Mexico to visit with a young woman that he had known in Paris where he'd been a student. She was a Parisian and she was teaching Spanish to the indigenous people, many of whom did not know Spanish in Mexico, which is still true. And so he invited her to go to Acapulco with him, and they did. And the story from there is a little murky, but they were arrested for malas intenciones. I love that charge. And whether the decision to terminate Energy Star is malas intenciones or incompetencia, it ought to be revisited. It really ought to be. Well, and in short, the Environmental Protection Agency is responsible more than any other agency of the government for the transformation of the environment in America. Punto. That's what you can know is your history. That is your achievement, and it's a very proud one. I think that it will stand the test of time, and I think that eventually we will see a return to the kinds of values and rigor of discipline that was demonstrated to achieve those results. I look back at the first Earth Day. I was around then. I was 2 weeks old with the Council on Environmental Quality. And I was given the job of finding out which projects were on the griddle that needed to be vetoed for Earth Day. And basically, we did find them. One was the Cross Florida Barge Canal, which had a lot of ecological issues associated with mixing the waters of the Gulf with the waters of the Atlantic. And when Earth Day came, there were some 20,000 people on Fifth Avenue alone, all across America, students, teachers, lawyers, people of all persuasions. If you were not an environmentalist on Earth Day 1970, you kept quiet about it. Well, that cultural excitement, the widespread nature of it, I think never completely went away. The enthusiasm, perhaps, it hasn't been equal since, but it was pretty great in 1990 as well, which I remember. And I recall that the first administrator, Bill Ruckelshaus, told me that during that period of the first 3 to 4 years, 1970s, he could not do enough for the environment. And he was constantly asked by members of Congress, isn't there something else you'd like to do? Wouldn't you like more money for this program or that program? And he said, I could hardly keep up with the request. I was batting them down because they were coming so fast. That was what it was like. And some of us, when I heard that story, I thought, oh God, I would have liked to have that experience. But that's what he had. And I think that I only learned this recently, the Cuyahoga River, which of course caught fire. Ruckelshaus famously testified that we were moving toward fishable, swimmable waters, but he couldn't say we'd gotten there in the early 80s, but at least he could test that the waters are no longer flammable. And that fire had taken place, or Cuyahoga had burned 12 times over the previous 100 years. Startled me when I just learned that recently. It only mattered on the 13th time, and that's because the culture was prepared and the country was attentive. We have to hope that doesn't happen again. I think the level of enforcement we just discussed with the press a little bit is very worrisome. We were told, and there will be an article apparently that will give the data, is the referrals to EPA are very few the first 3 months of the period. And one has to wonder where we will go from here if we're not going to be engaging in enforcement. The proposal to allow, if you have a technology problem, to simply write an email to EPA and it will automatically be conferred is a very bizarre kind of regulation that I'm not familiar with, but time will tell how it works. There is a proposal of here underway to take exactly the right course and make exactly the best use of the time that we have, and that is to look at the configuration that environmental regulation has entailed and reconsider it. When I look back at the kinds of thoughts that went into the first EPA, they were much more political than operational or than efficient. And NOAA ended up in the Commerce Department because the Secretary of the Interior, who otherwise would have gotten it, had attacked the Vietnam War policy of President Nixon. Well, I can attest to my own experience when I have met with commerce secretaries who seemed dimly aware that half their budgets were NOAA. That certainly was not why they were sent to the Commerce Department. They were typically trade people. At any rate, that ought to be corrected, and that agency, I think, ought to find a home in the Environmental Protection Agency, along with the concern for the oceans generally. But that's a personal perspective. There are other decisions that we would make differently. I think the research enterprise would be significantly expanded, which could be efficient. I look back at our budget director who said, why do you want to give the research people at EPA any more money? They'll just lift up more rocks and find more money to spend on it. And I said, yeah, that's probably right. But we know how important research is. And one of the real worrisome things is the disparagement of research and the collection and dispersal of data and the people who manage it right now at EPA and throughout the government. That's a topic for another time. But I hope that it takes seriously the prospect of rebuilding the agency and figuring out what it should be like, giving in, there's obviously time, about 46 months, to reflect on that. And I hope that this organization takes a part in that. So we can rebuild the EPA as Department of the Environment. And take heart, I think, alumni. We've always had our adversaries, though we generally confronted the enemy at the gates, not really within the walls of the enterprise. I think of the George H.W. Bush administration as a friendly one, the agency. The president really did smile on EPA in our time, I think. But even then, I can recall the counsel to the president, Boyden Gray, once consoled me after a dust-up with the chief of staff, Sununu. He said, it might make you feel better to know that John Sununu hates one institution even more than he hates EPA. And I said, pray tell, what could it be? He said, the Congress. Well, nothing wrong with that company. At any rate, even as this, I think, shameful chapter of environmental history is being written, let us plan and protect what we can while we hope the rivers do not burn again. As we plan for the future when Americans, embarrassed and regretful, give us back what we have had, what we have built so carefully over the years, we will then, I think, as a country, be able to reclaim the sunlit uplands and fight again. Thank you.
I know it, they go way back. I think this is right here. Hit, turns green light. Well, very good. Thank you so much for your observations, remarks, good advice, and everything. And I have a couple of questions to get the ball rolling, and then I'm confident that we've got a few moving forward to the front. You mentioned a number of things that you look back upon, mostly with pride, and maybe there were some that not quite as much pride, but in focusing on your time at EPA, because I know you have had a lot of other experiences, both private and public sector, but are there things that especially stand out to you? You mentioned green lights and Energy Star. Are there some other things that stand out in your mind that you feel really good about from your career?
Well, the market-based trading, that's part of the Acid Rain program, the Acid mm-hmm. Rain title of the Clean Air Act amendments, was a revolution, really, I think, in thinking. We were just talking to the press a little about it. And the fact that, and this has been signaled by a Harvard professor who's written a lot about the value of having automatic transmission of sensor data going straight to the agency and not requiring inspections that may not come for reasons of budget or whatever. I think that that's just one aspect of it, but that turned out to be a very good one. And someone, was it in the press just a while ago, knew that we had ways to test for carbon dioxide in those stacks?
Yeah.
Well, that was a secret.
Yeah.
We put it in there thinking that the moment would come, but had the chief of staff known that was in there, it never would have become
public.
So all you had to do was turn it on. And of course, it was a major source of CO2, all of these electric power plants. I think I say in a movie that I would encourage you to see if you haven't, a documentary that has been done. I was very worried about it when I heard it was being done, because I know I didn't think I was going to go off very well. And in one sense, I sure didn't. I was referred to as Dead Man Walking in the Variety magazine review, even though they liked the movie. The movie is The White House Effect, and it
discusses it, explains very accurately with archival materials, no doubting it, all true, that how we dealt with the climate issue toward the end of the Bush administration and how finally George Bush decided not to join the rest of the developed world and propose it to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I think he regretted that. I spent a long luncheon with him alone and explained what everybody was going to do, and particularly people he very much respected, like Helmut Kohl, whom I had met with at Kohl's suggestion on it. I'll never forget what Kohl said upon leaving me, my leaving his office. I had the longest meeting with him, I was told by our ambassador, Vernon Walters, that any American he'd ever taken in had. But Kohl said, as he stood, he looked me in the eye, and he said, "Upon your country and mine depend whatever hope this planet has to avert a climate catastrophe. And on your shoulders, Mr. Riley, rests the responsibility to bring your president to understand the significance of this issue." I was really stunned by that remark and chilled. Even repeating it, I feel chilled. So when he made the decision, I had made a big case of the fact that it was his premier legacy issue. It was, I said, as acid rain was to Reagan, and the ozone decision, which came out well in the Reagan administration. It always perplexed me that Reagan could have done that and we couldn't quite get reduction proposals, greenhouse gases. Incidentally, after the movie, I called George Mitchell and I said, if we really had proposed it in legislation, would we have passed it? He said, no, we would absolutely not. And then he reflected, he said, well, but I would have said the same thing about the Clean Air Act you proposed, and you got that through against Dingell and Byrd and a lot of people I didn't think you could overcome. So he said, I could be wrong. But what I really missed was if Bush had proposed to join the rest of the developed world in reducing, promising to reduce by 10-20%, by the way, only Germany made it, nobody else did. Canada was 30-some percent ahead of additional emissions by 2050, by the turn of the century, I guess, by 2000, then I think some of the venom and the partisanship would have been liftable from the issue, Republican president having validated climate. I think it would have made a difference. Could be wrong about that, but that's a regret, that we didn't quite bring him there, and why it's a particular regret, because 5 days after he made the decision he made, he had four of us to lunch. He started the luncheon by saying, tell me again, why is it that only we among the developed countries cannot handle this climate thing? Well, I wanted to say, weren't you there? At any rate, so that's a regret, but then I suppose I've got some others.
Yeah,
the staffing that the president made, I had a lot of regrets about that. Chief of staff selection, I would have liked to be consulted on all of those things. I wasn't.
Well, are we having some sound problems? So, Bill,
tie for you guys, by the way. We don't wear them in California anymore after COVID. Went to the funeral of my son-in-law's father. He didn't.
So the sulfur dioxide cap and trade was extraordinarily successful, and we got very dramatic reductions relatively quickly. After that time, I think it's really looked upon. Do you have a sense of why we were, and many other countries are trying this now in terms of pricing carbon emissions or taking a cap and trade approach, any sense of why that is not being successful, whereas sulfur dioxide was so successful? Or in this country, cap and trade, I don't, and with carbon dioxide, and put your mic up if you would.
Yeah, it has, well, it's not been really applied to.
Yep.
It has in California.
Well, they tried it in Canada, and now it's they're stepping back from it. So,
no, I couldn't really say, but it did really work for us, and it was a very efficiently applied. And I remember when the Europeans did it. The Europeans, I spent a lot of time in France, went to school there for a while. They had a habit of telling people when they were going to be inspected. And so they notified in advance. It was just the courtesy. That, and they left out a lot of sources, major sources of carbon dioxide,
yeah,
different industries. So it was kind of programmed not to run. And then they granted too many permits, way too many permits. So they had to cut back on that. There were a lot of efficiencies they could have learned from us, but didn't. But on the other hand, they were applying it to a larger space, to a larger economy of more than just electric power. So it's easy to criticize. But as to some of the others, I'm less familiar.
You spent a good part of your career in non-government organizations. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the important role that they play in the broader scheme of environmental protection and sustainability.
Well, I think, as I said to the Chinese, that having NGOs who were policing every move that anybody made in the government was extremely useful. It could get to be a pain in the neck, some of them, and I think some were more effective than others. I remember I was present, the president took me, the only environment minister ever taken to a G7 meeting. I went with President Bush, and we had language we were quite proud of on climate, and everybody agreed to it. And there was a member of the staff of World Wildlife Fund, Conrad von Moltke, who was present. And as Bush explained in the backyard of the ambassador's garden what we had done, he was telling the press that it was nothing. We were not really taking climate seriously. Well, we'd been in office about 10 minutes, and we had proposed a new Clean Air Act, and we hadn't had time to look at the economic impact of making the reductions Conrad wanted. But a reporter had just talked to Conrad, and he said to Bush, after Bush had taken some credit for this language, well, he said, environmentalists don't think of much of what you've done. And I never forget, I watched Bush say, environmentalists really don't think much of anything good has been done. They never like anything I do, something like that. And I remember thinking, we're losing him. And I can remember cabinet meetings where I would be defending some kind of proposal, the budget director or the chief of staff or somebody would say, well, you're never getting credit for that. You never get credit for it from those guys. And we never really, I didn't. And most of the press who covered the issues were sensitive to the fact that they were not playing fairly with, they treated, as Bush once said to me, he said, you know, I don't give them everything they want, but they treated me like I was Reagan.
Well, shifting gears a little bit, you touched on the role of EPA and the U.S. on the global scale. Environmentally, and the example in Estonia with dealing with an oil spill. What do you see as the appropriate role for the U.S. internationally in the environmental and sustainability world?
Well, I expect that the world will continue to look for the United States and look, if not to our government leadership, to our technologies, to some of our major companies, to some of the more benevolent gestures that come out of our society, like the Gates Foundation and a network of fantastic foundations across this country that no other country has anything like. They're all gearing up. They're a little shell-shocked at the moment. I've talked to some of them, and they're wondering how to deploy their resources, whether they can possibly step in and make up for the losses that government withdrawal has entailed. Probably not on the scale that they're losing. That was a point that Gates made. And I must say, he has the right to make that criticism. So they will continue to look to the non-governmental part of our society. And one has to hope that the government doesn't intrude to in ways that have been threatened to withdraw tax deductibility and things of that sort to some of our NGOs. I don't think that it's lawful. But if you look at Project 2025, It's very carefully calibrated to make rapid decisions that are incontestably unlawful, with the confidence that by the time the courts get around to addressing the problem, there will be a dispersal of the expertise of the scientists, the engineers, the people who are specialized in addressing whatever the problem is, so they can win even if they lose in court. And I really worry a lot about that and hope that at some point the courts develop a more rapid fire oversight. And some of them have done, some of the district courts have done that. They've just made their decisions to defer any act and any changes. Or I met a young man the other day who had written an article about me at in New Haven. And he was coming out of the cathedral after the Pope's memorial. And I said, what are you doing here? He said, I work here. I said, really, where do you work? He said, I work at the agriculture department. I said, well, good for you. Are you secure there? Well, he said, I have an interesting history. He said, I've been fired, and rehired thanks to a court decision. He said, you may imagine I'm very popular with my superiors. He said, if you know of anything, at any rate, that's true of so many people now.
Well, there has been a lot of litigation, and Bruce Diamond, who is very active in our academy, had put together a session on trying to get a handle on all the litigation that is going on. Unfortunately, we had to postpone it, but Bruce assures me that it's back in the works, and we hope to have that in the not too distant future. Bruce, do you have any questions for Bill that you want to share with us?
One question is, would you talk some about the focus on place-based initiatives?
Place-based initiatives. That's a personal favorite of mine. Now, is this a softball?
Did you plant that one?
I like that a lot. Well, you know, basically, I took very seriously Jacques Cousteau's aphorism that people protect what they love. And they don't love parts per million reductions. There's all a range of things, and I certainly learned in briefing Bush, you better make it personal. And so fairly often we overdid it by talking about the pollution threatening Walker Point in Maine. And he had a good sense of humor, so he put up with it. But place-based initiatives, one that I particularly liked was the estuary program. The estuary program, I recall getting into with some detail. I was really brought directly because the Bass brothers and their father, Perry, came to see me, the whole family. And they wanted to put Corpus Christi, Texas into the estuary program. And I remember said to Mr. Bass, I'm very familiar with Corpus Christi. I was confirmed in the cathedral in Corpus Christi. I was 10 or 11 years old, lived in Southern Texas. So he said, you know, will you do us a great favor, because it's rare that you get a convergence of business and environmentalist opinion in the state of Texas. And he was chairman of the Texas Wildlife Association. So he knew and had a very good record himself. Well, we discussed it and I said, you know, there are 25 that are eligible and you have to be recommended by your governor. And your governor has not proposed Corpus Christi. He said, she hasn't? Well, I don't think it was more than an hour after he left me that the governor of Texas and Richards proposed that Corpus Christi be added to the list, and I did. And then I've not received this from any other governor, a dozen yellow roses.
Very good, very good. Kevin, do you have any from the virtual crowd to share with us?
One question that a couple of people have submitted from the video chat is, what can people do as individuals during this time in order to keep the momentum going and not lose any more than we need to in the progress that's been made?
Wow. Vote, seriously. I spoke at Yale the other evening and said, you know, the movement here to Mau Mau the president by following him around when he speaks in different schools is not really constructive in trying to get him out of fossil fuels. If they knew how Yale works, they wouldn't bother the president. They'd talk to the guy who manages the finances, who is more valued than the president typically. But I said, if you really wanted impact on policy, you'd go down to the jurisdictions of Republicans, particularly people I know who have said to me, I understand these issues privately, and I have a lot of sympathy for them, but they are never raised. They don't come up when I have home visits. If they did, as you well know, there'll be somebody standing off to one side who will write down climate came up, and they'll get back in the office and they'll decide if there are enough times that happens, maybe we better look at that issue. But they're not getting any pressure to. And that's unfortunate. That's something that it doesn't have to be students, but the students are looking for action. They want to know what they can do. And I said, that's really something that would have a consequence.
Bruce, do you have another one?
Protecting wetlands, advocating for a broad waters of the United States definition was a central focus of your EPA tenure. Are states able to protect these resources as the federal government shrinks its protection?
Yeah, did everybody hear that? Are the states, Yeah, are the states able to protect wetlands?
Right. Protecting wetlands and advocating for broad waters in the United States definition was a central focus of your EPA tenure. Are states able to protect these resources as the federal government shrinks its protection?
Well, my recollection is that wetlands protection originated at the state level. I think Wisconsin was key. Not positive of that, but the hunters and fishermen were very concerned about the loss of wetlands, and particularly the ducks. I remember Marilyn Quayle at one point, I guess the last night we were together, somebody seated me next to her at the last dinner for the president, and she said something negative about wetlands. And I said, well, you take your state of Indiana, 90% of the wetlands are probably gone. But she said, and your brother's a big duck hunter. And she said, there are more ducks than we know what to do with in the ponds that are remaining. I said, well, that's because you're taking away so much of their habitat. Anyway, there is support for that, certain kinds of wetlands, not for the periodic, what they call ephemeral wetlands. That's a very hard thing to defend. I remember I was invited along with Carla Hills and Colin Powell to the signing of the North American Free Trade Agreement by President Clinton. And he took me a big embrace and he whispered in my ear, he said, he said some nice things about me to the crowd. And then he said, I'm going to keep our administration exactly where you were on wetlands. Then he whispered to me, God, what a thankless political issue that one is. At any rate, I think for a number of states, it'll be very difficult. But so many states that have lost, like Florida is a good example, such a huge proportion of their wetlands, they will perhaps recognize if they're not going to protect them for ecological reasons, they do have a lot to do with resilience in the event of storms, sea level rise, and hurricanes. So that kind of education could be very usefully applied. On the other hand, wetlands is one of those issues that affects banks, builders, farmers. It's got constituency after constituency that have problems with it. So I don't think in the next 4 years, I'm very positive about the likelihood that we will do a very good job there.
Well, you alluded to this, but I'll underscore the work, I'll call it in the NGO sector. Ducks Unlimited has done a phenomenal job in terms of working with the agricultural community and elsewhere to preserve or protect over 13 million acres of wetlands. And that kind of voluntary collaborative approach, I think, has been quite successful.
It has. I was at an event in Iowa where I heard farmers talk about the Gulf of Mexico. I was a little startled. I grew up in farm country. I'd never heard that kind of thing before, but they very knowledgeably, they were aware that soils and contaminants were washing off their farms down through the Missouri and the Mississippi rivers and responsible for the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So there is an ethos in many places, and the farmers share in it. And one has to hope that they will do good with it.
Kevin, anything more from the virtual world? Bruce, another one from the live world here.
Well, this is, maybe it's a question, but it's almost more of a plea, which is, what is the most effective way that we can push back against the cuts to EPA?
Probably it's the vote. It's the vote. Vote. Vote for people who do not support. It's worth remembering, I said this to the press an hour or so ago, that President Trump previously, in his previous term, submitted four budgets over the 4 years. Each of them would have cut EPA by about a third or more, staffing and finance. And Congress did absolutely nothing with those budgets. The Republicans and Democrats, Republicans never got credit for it. Probably they didn't want credit for it, but they did not agree to that. So the budgets were kept constant. One has to hope that that happens again.
Well, very good. Administrator Riley, you'll always be my administrator.
Thank you, Dave.
He actually offered me my job as deputy regional administrator, and so I'll be forever grateful to him for that. We will be forever grateful to you for joining us tonight and sharing your experiences. And as importantly, there we are. Right.
Let me just recognize Terry Davies, who's on this call.
Oh, there he is. Yeah.
Partner in all sorts of things we did at the Conservation Foundation, World Wildlife Fund, and then EPA. So nice to have you with us, Terry. Maybe you'd like to add something.
Well, they've got him muted, so I think he won't be able to. But we thank you very much, Bill, for your time and your wisdom and your insights for us. So please join me.